All right, we are live. Hello, everybody. Hello, and welcome to our not so regular Wednesday stream. We do apologize for any audio issues during the stream. I do have a guest this week, but there's been some microphone confusion, some microphone issues, some disappearing bits. And as it happens, he's currently on a phone, but he's legible, he's hearable, so it should be a good stream anyway. We do apologize for any audio quality issues, but that's just the way it's got to be sometimes. The modern world does let us down. For those of you waiting for the weather report, it's December. I don't know what you want. It's drizzling. It's cold. It's foggy. It's a bit miserable. But this is actually, and I had it on screen, the actual result of the Ko-fi. Thank you to I'll introduce you in a sec, Lewis, but thank you to Lewis as well for commissioning the previous video on peak oil. Like I said, if people do have video ideas, I am a little bit picky with them, but if they're a good idea, I will take your money. Thank you to everybody for the support. People have been really good. Yes, the Monday stream as well did get taken down, but you can watch that on our Odyssey page. If you look at our community, post that we're there, but also I will probably put
Good
it. Oh, there it
evening.
is. It started playing itself. But we also do have an Odyssey backup page, and that's where you can find our crayon drawing stream that was unfortunately yeeted on Monday. But Lewis, do you want to say hello and introduce yourself a little bit?
Hello, everyone. My name is Lewis. Yes, I was the previous patron of the EROI stream, as commissioned of last week, I believe, if my memory is not
I
melting
think so. I
away.
think it was last week. I'm thinking it might not be now.
So my background is in engineering, and I think that's all I really need to say regarding that. And I just find the EROI subject rather interesting. And on a deeper subject, on a deeper note, sorry, the EROI, oh, I couldn't mispronounce that. ERO,
I always do that. Energy return on
energy return on
investment.
energy investment. That's the one that I'm
Yes.
more interested in. But yes, so if there is any problems with the microphone again, I do apologize. I'm having to use earphones and I don't have a wired connection or a computer, I'm afraid, at the moment.
A bit of a downer, but you're here and we're getting on with it. Because a lot of people have actually asked for what this is. And I've got your stuff on screen. There is some stuff in the description below because you've got your Rebellious Revitalization Substack as well. I've kind of shielded you as that so people don't think you're Louis Levi. Because I wouldn't want that to
No,
be
no,
I wouldn't
no,
want that to be false advertising.
no. No.
But yes, we will. And you've also recommended a Substack called The Slabland Chronicles, which has been recommended to me before. So
Yes,
that's a
that
pretty
was
good
me
one.
that recommended it last time. I can't remember how long ago that was now. Many months ago now.
Well, I don't mean to insult people's intelligence in this, but we will be going through some relatively elementary physics. Again, it almost falls on a little bit from the crayon drawing stream that we did in this. We'll go
A
through.
crayon drawing of how the energy grid
Well,
works.
it's a crayon drawing also of just the basic physics mistakes that are made by the overarching current thinking of green energy, because as I'll get to in the end, I don't want to undermine my own point here. But really, making a scientific argument with most people, and I will re-stress this at the end, isn't worth it because most people do not understand basic physics. But does anyone remember this? Raise your hand in chat. Can we get some Mises? Ooh, Mises. No, this is just how you extract work done from a heat engine. And it's a very reliable way of extracting quantifiable, predictable, and on-demand work from an energy system. It is what we have used for many years. It's what we will continue to use mostly. And the transitioning away from this cycle, and from the greater energy potential that something like superheated steam gives us in the modern era, I know a lot of people get a lot of your normie takes in engineering will be, "Oh my God, we still run on steam power." Have you heard
Yes,
that one?
we do. Yes, surprisingly, it works quite well.
Because that blows a lot of, "Oh, mind blown, man!" But a jet
I
engine.
think I was about. Sorry.
Oh, that's fine. Go on.
I was just going to say, I think I remember I was unfortunately one of those people around 14 years of age when I had my mind blown. I was like, oh, that's what. Wait, nuclear reactors are just. Oh, they're just big steam engines that you just use radiation to to create the theme. Ah.
It's very reliable, and it's very, very, you know, it's very, it's technology we know how to use. It's very precise. Turbine design's quite good. We've got a lot of efficiency gains in it. We know how it works. We can place it very safely near, you know, relatively near people's dwellings.
Yeah.
It's fast. It's safe. It's reliable. It's predictable. And as I said, the energy difference in a heat engine, if you've forgotten your Year 8 physics, a jet engine can make a plane fly when a steam engine can't, because there's a bigger difference between the hot reservoir and the cold sink, and therefore you can get more work out of it. That's just how physics works, that's how thermodynamic works, and going from a greater energy state to a lower energy state is how you create work. And if you're using a dynamo, like you're doing a wind turbine, or if you're using a photoelectric, which is a bit different in the solar generation, what we're getting now is this move away from predictable, usable energy in a heat engine cycle that you're getting work out of via a turbine. You're moving to the massive surface area of wind turbines. You're moving to the massive surface area of these solar farms. And the energy difference, the energy they're taking in a raw sense, is lower. And therefore, the energy they can take out of those energy sources is lower. Because the wind does have immense force, but you have to build immense surface area turbines to harness it. And it becomes very diminishing in terms of the energy you can get out of it. And obviously, there's the other inconveniences that come from it as well. But thermodynamically, all of these green energy sources simply do not have the energy generation potential that something like, you know, burning a fossil fuel will. A high energy exchange will always give you more reliable and concentrated energy than something that is much more lower energy. And that's a very, 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 very basic principle of getting mechanical work and getting power, literal power, as in, you know, James Watt power out of anything. And that's something that a lot of normal people they can't understand this. They physically aren't wired for it. I don't know what it is, but I've tried to explain this to quite a few people.
They don't have the tisms.
No. And energy return on investment is largely down to this. If you're talking about a heat engine system, your energy return on investment will be due to the difference between the cold sink and the hot reservoir. That is what actually makes more work possible out of a system like that. And it is something extremely fundamental to physics. I'm driving a point home, but it's something that provably, I think, that the managerial class does not understand this. Many of you will understand this, but the managerial class does not understand this. And not really understanding this, not really understanding the next thing here, it's a bit smaller, which is to do with, you know, losses in generation, and we know secondary energy, final energy, and the useful energy. It's how energy is actually used throughout the grid and how it arrives to people. They also don't seem to understand this part either. Because we've talked a little bit off air about all of this, and you've obviously Telegram DMs and all that, and you've noticed exactly what I have as someone from a technical background.
Yes.
What do you think is the most insidious lie people believe about green energy then, before we go too much further?
That it is self-sustaining. I think that's probably the core one. If you were ever to sit down and just bring it up with somebody, again, going back to your video on the Monday?
Yes.
Regarding the crayons. It's not so much that they even provide a crayon drawing. It's more so that they eat the crayons, they process them, and then you get a very colourful rainbow-coloured, dump at the end of it, and that is effectively what they consider to be green energy. In effect, it's this completely dumbed down idea that if we just build enough wind turbines, it's self-sustaining. They're completely ignoring the maintenance aspect of the wind turbines and solar farms and etc.
Yes.
Just in terms of, as previously stated, just the raw energy output and input is lower. So thereby you actually need to build far more of them to even have the same energy output as, say, a coal-fired power station or a gas turbine or a nuclear power station.
It's part of the branding, the renewables aspect of it. This branding idea that these are unlimited sources of free energy. Most people understand the renewables. Yeah. It's like Fern Gully. They understand the renewables push as the big evil oil corporations versus, like, you know, the Earth Mother Science people who have found the key to infinite energy, and the big mean oil people don't want them to have the free unlimited energy because of capitalism. And that's actually how it's sold to people. That is the crayon drawing, if you will, of climate change to people. But it doesn't involve any of this.
Yeah.
The generation of electricity doesn't change the, and as we'll get onto this as we get further onto it, the transmission of energy, it doesn't really change the consumption of energy, and it doesn't really change the amount of useful energy we can get out of many different devices. Because yes, we have made efficiency gains like LED bulbs and things like that, but we also have massively more power intensive active systems that keep our homes running in the modern era. So it's kind of six of one and a half dozen the other.
Another good example would be a lot of the push for various governments to have large data centers for quote-unquote artificial intelligence. The amount of energy that is required for those is immense. I mean, it's larger than most cities, which is just bonkers, really, when you start seeing the numbers for those.
Oh, thank you for the £5 there, Shy Strike, as well. Hello, friends. I love that one nation near Cyprus. I hope you all do, too. Also, make another event, please. We're trying on the events front. Obviously, with all of this, we are on Collapse Watch. I know we're always on Collapse Watch now, but I brought Collapse Watch back out.
Well, you haven't used it in a while, have you?
No. I made that and I want to use it. But another really, really basic fact of the green energy debate is the fact that we have lost power generation capacity since the 1990s. It peaked in about 2005, and every year, apart from a couple of notable spikes, every year since 2005 peak, we have seen a reduction in aggregate energy generation. And obviously in the same time period, we have seen massive increases in population. Population in 2000 was officially 49 million. The population in 2023 is officially 57 million, but people think it's probably closer to, much closer to 70 than that. Well, that's the population of England, sorry. Maybe that's my mistake. But the population of England itself only has increased, 49 million to 57 million officially. And this is the BBC trying to celebrate the reduction in coal, gas, and oil. But really what it's doing is slyly revealing to people that the amount of energy generation has peaked and then quite sharply dropped, because this is quite a small scale here. We've gone from a peak of nearly 400 terawatt hours down nearer to 300 terawatt hours, which is a massive drop in energy generation capacity there. That is a huge drop. And I noticed that if you search it on Google, it doesn't come up with anything apart from self-congratulatory stuff about these are the Google search results. This is what I get anyway. The electricity from fossil fuels dropped the lowest level. You know, it's all this kind of stuff. What you get is self-congratulatory, really wankery about the amount of electricity dropping and aren't we good, but it doesn't talk about the raw aggregate drop.
No.
Oh, excuse me, they're taking it. Need a quick drink.
Sorry.
Oh, no, it's fine. I was going to say the basic facts of the electricity energy electricity generation grid are hidden from the population in quite stark ways. What do you think that the long-term effect of that will be? Do you think there'll be like Ukraine stuff, this wake-up moment for people where they'll have to create a narrative around energy rationing because you've seen a bit of that? But we're kind of laying out the facts and we're laying out the fact that, you know, we've had this energy transition, but it's transitioned just to making less energy, but nobody seems to really know about it. We're a bit of an odd in-between situation here.
I think we're, if you were to say in a, say, a cycle, we're probably in the sort of middle position. So it is still part of the, to use the, again, the term, energy transition, you know, the government approved verbiage. we're still in the middle of it, so we haven't actually transitioned into that place where, because again, the gas is, well, it's natural gas, isn't it? So that, you know, that's emissions. So they're going to want to get rid of gas and nuclear. So they'd rather move everything into wind and solar. So I think that that graph has shown now will actually, well, it'll get worse. I think that's just a fact. I don't, it might look something like Ukraine, maybe, in that they're dealing with massive, regarding the population, having to deal with massive amounts of, well, massive lack of easily affordable and cheap energy, essentially. I think that it's just going to go away. And they are going to ration it. I think that will happen. So,
well, it's also like, it's not like the amount has gone lower, but the electricity's got cheaper, because quite famously, the UK has the world's highest industrial electricity costs. Here's the famous graph from the Financial Times, where apart from the other big, you know, apart from the top four producers, everywhere else in the world has business electricity rates less than half of what Britain has, which in terms of a production point of view is absolutely disastrous. All these facts added together, you know, you've got the price, you've got the lack of, you've got the population increase, the lack of generation, all of these things are compounding to create this quite acute energy crisis. And it's undeniable that the energy policy of the last 20 years has been a complete failure, because generation is lower than it was in the mid-90s, and prices are far, far higher than anywhere else in the world.
Indeed. I think it might have something to do with that. Obviously, the fact that the total generation is essentially down, and as a result, they're having to make up part of that from importing it from, you know, either France, the Netherlands, not Germany, because they're in the same boat production wise for energy. Going down quite fast, actually.
Well, that actually net imports here. Net imports have increased a bit. But if we go over here, they're only really a thin crust on top of the... it's even smaller than coal is currently. The net imports have increased. There's a lot of talk about importing electricity. But actually, the viability of it, it's only at extreme peak load times. The actual net import of electricity, it's increased recently, but it is relatively low. It's almost about the same sliver as hydro is in this country.
So it's a different factor then. So there's a different factor that's not visible at this moment in time, or it's just hidden under all the data and the numbers.
Well, it seems really that the factor here is the energy transition itself. The UK has been tooting its horn, and we'll go through some of these sources and follow. I won't go through this one, but the UK has definitely been tooting its horn in terms of its green energy. And the point I'm going to make for your more economic nerds is that this is the environment, you know, this is the energy reality, all this decrease in production, all this decrease in capacity. This is the reality with all the subsidies. It seems that the managerial class has confused financial return for energy return. They've fixed the numbers and done some money magic. But subsidies can only fudge the financial balance sheet. They can't make them energy viable. They can make them commercially viable, in quotes, with enough subsidies. But in terms of raw energy in versus energy out, it doesn't make them more viable. And it creates these massive malinvestment signals and creates investment in unproductive methods of electricity generation. It's really, it's nuts and bolts what we talked about many years ago when we did more economic stuff about some of the more Misesian stuff. You know, free market economics, in quotes, is a peacetime activity within a, you know, controlled sovereign nation with you know, absolute power over its own policy. I don't believe in money magic. I don't believe in fairy libertarianism. I believe economics is a peacetime pursuit. But as far as it goes, it's very, very classic malinvestment. It's very, very classic bad incentives. And the picture is this bad, and the electricity is this expensive with the subsidies. That's the shocking part to people. This is subsidized electricity.
You'd think that it'd be get a bit cheaper, but no. I'm
afraid it don't work like that, and I'm afraid to our southern viewers, this is also a rather northern stream. So.
It just doubts sometimes. You know what I mean?
It just doesn't. I know. Sometimes the problem is my northernness varies. It gets a bit more extreme sometimes, and sometimes I turn it on. I don't know. I have quite a variable accent because I've lived too many places. But if I think about it, if I can do it. People around here do sound like Peter Kay though. So I got to try and not get too end of your street, but. it varies. I can turn my northern accent. If I'm talking to Americans, I talk a bit more like this. You know, you really lay it on thick. You really give them the old
I've met the Queen. Yes.
Oh yes, we all live in three streets near Buckingham Palace, and isn't England all lovely and wibbly? Yes.
Yes.
Oh dear, yeah. No. It does. To be fair, the I gotta stop laughing now. But this story here in the Times, the UK is racing ahead of the world on green energy. Indian billionaire Pashrant Risha is building a new refinery on the banks of the Mersey that will run on hydrogen, making it the UK's first emission-free plant. Yeah, look, this I chose
magic.
This.
It's magic, John. It's magic. They're using space magic, and I just don't think about it.
They're using Indian space magic.
Indian Hindutsva space magic.
For those in the know about green energy, one of the biggest jokes, even internally, is the viability of hydrogen power stations and hydrogen filling stations. A large part of the infrastructure has moved away from hydrogen.
Hmm.
Mostly because it's an extremely difficult gas to transport and extremely explosive, so...
Oops, it's gone up. Bang.
Basically, yes. But it's also... what we see with the green energy bubble and the green energy misunderstanding of science is a lot of it is led by... initially, you get these tech companies that are given a lot of public funding, and often they will plough that public funding magically back into the political parties and back into the political structure for lobbying. And it's less dirty than normal lobbying because it's green lobbying. And you end up with
I've got dirt. It's dirt and grass I'm using to lobby with, all right?
But the it's you know, we're lobbying for the trees, guys. You can't hate the tree lobby. But then you end up with this. It's tech billionaires taking on massive subsidies and being given huge tax breaks by the UK government to fart about and create something that in the aggregate consumes more energy than it ever produces. And that is the main problem, because I had a little bit of, a dissident physics teacher. He was a doctor of physics. And he got us to do some of the energy equations. And if you do a lot of the energy equations for things like wind turbines, and you factor in transportation, maintenance, and the fact that these things have vastly lower life cycles than they're supposed to, and we'll get into that in a little bit. In fact, we're not even going to talk about too much of that stuff, because that stuff, I think, is a given. If you look into wind power, a lot of the predictions and the lobbying predictions for wind especially have been so comically bad that the industry itself has had to de-emphasize wind slightly when it comes to, you know, generation targets, because they fall so far in reality below what they should be, as we'll get to, that they've become a joke.
Yes.
But the whole point is that all of these end up as these malinvestment circles, where you end up with a tech company that's been given government grants, lobbies the government to do more green things, and what you have is a lot of the tech fluff is you get nothing at the end of it. But this isn't abstract like apps are. This isn't abstract like, you know, IT solutions for the public sector are. This is concrete. This is old world. This is heavy industry, and this is energy production. And because they don't understand it and keep listening to basically Indian tech scammers about what their energy needs.
I can sell you a good price on wind farm, yes.
Hello, sir, yes. I will sell you UK government new hydrogen plants, sir. Very cheap, yes. Very good, yes.
yes, oh, yes, bloody hell.
Oh, dear, but that's what... there's a lot of that going on. And we did that stream with Harry, Harry Robinson, about how competent are the elite. And when it comes to things like this, when it comes to... And you'll know it, you're an engineer... When it comes to this, it's very clear that the people in charge are not technically competent.
No, they're not. No. I think as a prime example, there was a company that me and my gaffer went to semi-recently. It was about a month and a half, maybe 2 months ago. I can name the company. It's not a problem. It's called Nikon. It's a Japanese company, and they've apparently they've set up shop in England, so around near where I am. I won't be spilling where that is. So they set up shop, and apparently they're going to be selling all these parts and all these other gubbins and stuff, but they're not making them here. But when you actually ask the people that are in charge of essentially running it, essentially the managers, you know, again, these are not elites. These are people lower down just running a company on behalf of somebody else. They don't seem to be that competent, and that's on the lower level. So I can only dream and fantasize about what kind of conversations you would have with, say, Liz Truss.
Well, so. I'm sure you've had the experience that I've had, because I work, you know, I've worked in manufacturing before. I've done a little bit of energy and oil and gas, and I've mostly done the mechanical services end of the construction industry. That's where I work. I will not be more specific than that. I have a speciality in a very, very specialized area. But I work with mechanical services. I do a lot of coordination for certain buildings, but I also do a considerable amount of what I consider like engineering dog's body work, of working out if certain solutions will work, working out if certain things will work. So I end up in all kinds of meetings with all kinds of people, at all kinds of level. And even, you know, even when it comes to things like the interface between the public and private sector, I get a good slice of how things work in Britain. And it has become very clear to me, even over the, you know, kind of 10 years I've been a full-time as an engineer about now, the technical competence of clients has definitely dropped. The technical competence, especially of quote-unquote project managers who work for outside firms, has massively dropped. There's a huge influx of non-technical people into jobs within technical companies. I can only imagine how bad it is in government itself and in the public sector itself and in places like, you know, the Department for Business and places like that, where there's not really an impetus on people being technical people. I have a slice of it from the construction industry and from other bits and pieces I do. I won't be too specific because that'll be a bit of a giveaway. Yeah. But I have noticed a definite loss of technical skill within middle managers who are supposed to be working for technical companies. That's been quite alarming.
As a middleman, basically. Mm. And I've seen the very same thing regarding larger companies that we've occasionally done parts for. The company myself, we've made, not me specifically, it was McGaffer. He made a part for, I believe it was for McLaren, of all people. And it was shocking because the person that provided the drawing, they provided, most people might not be that relevant or might not be able to grasp it straight away, but essentially there was a hole in it. And it was dimensioned at 8 millimeters, and then it wanted to be tapped, so it wanted to be threaded internally, and it was measured, and that was tolerance that, well, an M8. So for those that don't know, an M8 tap needs to go in a hole that is actually smaller than 8 mil.
Yes, you'd put, and yeah, for those of you who don't know, yes, the width of the tap, so the outer edge of the teeth is 8 mil. It's not a tap for an 8 mil hole, because you can technically mil tap different, slightly different size holes depending on what you want to get in and out. You're flexible like that. But yes, oh God, excuse you. I have the same problem. And that you end up with, not like that, but you end up with the non-technical people.
Sorry.
I'm sorry. So what was happening with your 8 mil tap? M3 taps. I've had drawings given to me with M3 taps. Banter. The banter is in full swing.
That's good. It's always good. Right, sorry. Yeah, so we'll move past the 8 mil tap now.
But it is. I've encountered that. I especially end up dealing with salespeople for certain companies who have absolutely no technical knowledge to the point that I'm making very basic requests for information off a sales department to determine whether or not I should if I'm buying the right type of machine or I'm buying the right type of a thing, and I just get I get nothing back. I get like a blank stare, basically.
Yeah, it's the it's almost like the NPC meme, isn't it, where they just stare at
No, we're not going to get lost in manufacturing autism for an hour here. Well, the point we're getting to
nothing.
is that because of things like that, because of a lot of lack of technical knowledge, even in the technical areas, within the economy, you don't get it within areas of government, and that leads to here's an article from this is from Bloomberg in Canada. The UK is paying £1 billion to waste a record amount of wind power. Wind farms being shut off at record-setting pace. It's because the theoretical generation of the wind farms is dependent on the wind. It feels like you should be tapping your head and going, cut the wind. It only makes power when the wind blows. That's what talking to green energy people feels like. But it's just, that's what it is. It's just exactly what it's like. It's like, well, yeah, no shit. No shit, we're wasting £1 billion. Our power generation is completely dependent on the whims of the wind. And guess what? It tends to be windy and stormy at night when the temperature gets a bit colder sometimes, when the air moves around a bit more.
And that's when nobody is using the energy.
And there's all of this stuff. And there's all this stuff about storing energy. And but we
The
don't have
batteries,
effective. Yeah. Well, you've heard all this stuff
I know.
about.
I actually know about this personally because there is actually supposed to be, it's been 3 years, and there's supposed to be a large set of batteries that are supposed to be built on this car park that's right next to my workplace,
But the
and they haven't touched
batteries.
it. What about the battery? Batteries.
Are these massive battery banks? If it's across from where your work is, they're also a massive fire risk.
Oh yeah, because lithium, cadmium,
It's also a little bit of a. Here's some inside knowledge from the construction industry. A lot of
Oh.
car parks that are built new now, a new bespoke car park has to technically have a high hazard fire suppression system in it because lithium polymer batteries in cars
Melts through time.
are considered such a fire load risk that they are like having you have to have the same kind of fire protection you put in like a factory or somewhere where you stored like masses of lithium ion batteries or lithium polymer batteries because lipos are just they has anyone ever seen like a major lipo fire, like a proper lipo fire?
I've done that myself. I've got a knife and I've stabbed a semi-dead battery before just to see what happened. And well, that was exciting. I was just curious. That was exciting.
I've seen quite a large lithium polymer array go from a friend of mine who, weirdly enough, used to build like medium weight like Robot Wars robots, BattleBots bots, stuff like that. Those
Oh,
have quite
cool.
big lipos in them. And one of his went, and I just remember it being ridiculously energy dense. It's just the fire you get out of them is like it's like weird magic fire. It makes your monkey brain go ah, but it's yeah. One of the
Ooga, dance around the fire.
yes, but one of the unintended consequences of the green energy transition, in quotes, is that paradoxically, cars are no longer full of explosive. The dinosaur juice that goes bang in your engine is less explosive than dangerous than the electric battery. It turns out your clean green car is a much bigger fire risk than the car that quite literally runs on explosions, which seems strange, but that's just how things have worked out. I'll just read a bit more of the story here. A burgeoning capacity and blustery weather should have given huge growth in output in 2024, but the grid can't cope, forcing the operator to pay wind farms to turn off a cost ultimately borne by the consumers. It's a situation that puts at risk plans to decarbonize the network by 2030 and makes it harder to cut bills. The thing is the wind is they could sometimes they get past the point of generation, which I believe is the contractors. They don't have to be paid for that. But if they can still keep making energy and the grid can't take it, They have to be paid for that energy. Otherwise, their business doesn't make any sense. So it's not only that it's £1 billion wasted in terms of, oh, £1 billion worth of energy just wasn't used. It's no, this energy was generated. We paid for it like it had been generated. So it's a double whammy, but it wasn't put into the grid. So you pay for it, and yet you don't get it. Which
it's really
is
funny that, because my mother, before she went out tonight and with my father, she was asking me this, and I couldn't quite answer it because I wasn't aware of this little bit here that we've just covered now. This is something, this little bit here is new to me, but there you go, you learn something new every day.
Oh well, of course, they couldn't economically make people build these wind farms if they didn't pay them for every single bit of energy that was produced, whether it was used or not. That's the only pricing that can work, but it's not the supplier's fault that the grid can't use it. The grid should be efficient enough to use it. Which brings us on to our next nightmare. Another article from Bloomberg. UK energy regulator Ofgem approves £2 billion wind power link. This is where the price of copper is skyrocketing. All kinds of all kinds of initiatives like this and all kinds of projects like this are creating a massive demand that shouldn't exist really and wasn't there before for copper and for copper products, because all of these inconveniently placed wind farms, they don't reckon with demand and they don't reckon with generation. And all of this is being put up because it is subsidized, as we've seen. So you get paid whether they can use the energy or not. So there is no synchronicity. In fact, the incentives are almost at odds with each other. The wind turbine producers don't care if the grid can't use it. So it's not an integrated approach. And that, again, most people would say that's absolutely insane, but that is just the way things are done. Again, if you also account for the fact that I'll give you some inside baseball about the energy equations here. The energy equations for wind turbines are very sneaky because they take into account all of the produced energy in its lifetime, which looks great. It looks like you're producing loads and loads of energy, but what they should actually show is the amount of usable energy that is created by these, because as we all know, a fossil fuel power plant can adjust what it is burning due to demand. A wind farm is the opposite relationship as we're talking about here, in that they must be paid for what they make no matter what demand is, which is an insane way to generate electricity. But it allows them to say, look at all this amazing energy that these wind farms have produced. It's not our fault we couldn't use it. They were still producing it. And therefore, wind farms are a great way to produce energy. But it's a lie. It's not integrated to actual usage. We come all the way back here to... Oh, I might have closed it, but the... We come all the way back here to the, you know, to this, to the, you know, what is the useful work you get out of it? What is the useful work done at the end in people's homes by, you know, the generation here? And it's just not there. The question isn't asked properly, and the sums are made in such a way that this is what is used to calculate the energy that was produced by the wind farms, not the usable energy. And those two are very different numbers. And that's only one part of the shell game of how on paper green energy works. But in practice, it creates massive shortages and huge spikes in prices. A very clear work example there.
On top of that as well, if you were to actually look this up yourselves, what you'll find is a slight problem that the information that the internet or broadly just Google provides will provide you the statistics for a wind farm. So that's, and that could be, there could be 10, there could be 20, there could be a offshore wind farm, could be 100 singular wind turbines in that singular farm. So the actual number that you're given for total energy production is actually not what you get for each individual turbine. Each individual turbine might produce a different amount of energy depending on down to the motors and so forth. Some can produce more than others, but that's just a quibbling over a little bit of data within that.
Oh, thank you for the other £2 there, Shy Strike. Donate used cables to save the grid, Milliband 2025. You remember the Millibands? You remember Millie Band? Two Millie Bands. Isn't it weird that two brothers were competing for the leadership of the Labour Party? And the wrong one won, and then the other one went off to go sulk at the UN. Because David Miliband's like a deep cut now. He's like an obscure side character. You know? I feel like I'm naming Obsidian NPCs or something stupid like that. Talking about David fucking Miliband. But these are the useless things my head is full of. But yeah, they're going to spend £2 billion to put more cables crisscrossing the UK so they can continue to waste energy because having all the wind farms interconnected doesn't change when the grid demand is, you idiot. Again, I feel like just going, it's when the wind blows, it's not the amount of cables you've got, but, you know, I feel like some of the streams we do could just be reduced to us, like, picking up, getting pictures of politicians just going, just really, really, really hamming it off. Of course it doesn't work. I mean, this is what my politics are. My politics are looking people directly in the eye.
You see, government.
Yeah, you can't see me doing it, but I'm doing the arm and everything. You know, you gotta get your arm going.
I can feel it through the audio.
All of this adds up really to a form of energy Lysenkoism, where green energy is supposedly cheaper and more efficient, but energy prices, even when subsidized, have skyrocketed and real production fallen. I just tell you what, I would just like to read this in full, because this is like a bingo card of the politicization of the generation of energy. This is an announcement from the 19th of November. It's a press release from the Office of the Prime Minister. Prime Minister launches Global Clean Power Alliance as UK leads the global energy transition. Prime Minister has officially launched the UK-led Global Clean Power Alliance in a major boost for the world's clean energy transition. I'll miss the bullet point. The Prime Minister, it's repeating itself. Where's the bit here? Because a lot of this is actually waffle. I was going to read it in its entirety, but now I've completely changed my mind. The Global Clean Power Alliance will have the missions to address the most critical energy transition challenges. First of these is the finance mission, which will be published today and co-chaired by Brazil, will harness the political leadership needed to unlock private finance on a huge scale, so that no developing country is left behind. It's another kind of public, here we go, it's the public-private partnership again, it's everything we talk about. It commits to supporting countries to build investment platforms and providing the assistance needed to get clean finance flowing. It's also a little bit Belt and Road. There's all of this stuff coming out here, and it's all about getting the third world in basically green debt. There's a finance mission here. There's about financializing their energy grid further and cushioning the blow. And don't worry, you'll pay for it in 10 years and things like that. The UK is leading the way in the green energy transition. Oh boy, are we? Because we're basically committing suicide here.
Yes, sir.
We're leading the way, which means we're worst off, literally. highest electricity prices in the world. One of the Prime Minister's missions is to make Britain a clean energy superpower, making the British people better off by investing in clean homegrown power to end national exposure to fossil fuel markets and the dictators who control them. What is my war propaganda doing in my Lysenkoist climate science propaganda? There's peanut butter in my chocolate over here.
There's peanut butter in my chocolate. Why is there jam in my peanut butter sandwich? What?
Exactly.
I didn't ask for this.
Yeah, but there's God, Energy Secretary Ed Miliband, David Lammy, but that's the whole point is that the government is extremely proud of this. They're extremely proud of this. They're extremely proud of this. So much so that they put out press releases like this. So this is effectively them taking responsibility proudly for the price of energy and the production of energy. Line does indeed go up. But there's a newsletter here, because this is the UN. The UN says renewables, cheapest form of power from 2022.
Oh, yeah.
We've got it. Yeah, renewable power remains cost competitive amid fossil fuel crisis. Costs of renewables continue to fall, blah, 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 blah. We have all of this. We even have now, I don't know if you've seen this or not, UNESCO's Global Initiative for Information Integrity on Climate Change. So the UN is telling us, it's very don't believe your lying eyes. This and this are mutually exclusive. That cannot be true whilst this also happening. So there's a bit of a big thunk to be done here. A bit of thunking needs to be done on the behalf of the UN.
Big thinking in it, bro. No, I'm saying.
How much do you encounter? Because I always like to ask people this, like the climate propaganda stuff in your everyday life. How often do you see what you would think of as pieces of climate propaganda?
Oh, that's a good question, that. I think the only times I ever actually see it is usually traveling to and from work. It's not so much around where I live. It's more so to essentially not even where I work itself. Again, it's in that between space, that middle space of trying to get from home to work. Is you and that's usually on the train via the advertisement boards and so forth, usually.
This is
That that's about it for me.
this is something I've noticed, and that you will notice though sometimes there's bits and pieces of it in advertising generally, but it's something that is restricted to like these nowhere zones. It's everywhere in cities, but cities are places where nobody lives. You'll notice it pervasively in the kind of the decharacterized areas of Britain. I'd say that a lot of the climate change propaganda and a lot of the climate change believers are from these weird constructed nowhere places. There's this strange divide between kind of the NIMBY telegraph reading activists, don't put houses on my fields people, and the climate change activist types in quotes who are universally urbanites, which is something that people occasionally comment on, but I don't think it's emphasized enough that there is a complete divide between the people who live in the countryside and the people who claim to defend the countryside. None of the people who claim to defend the countryside actually live in the countryside, or
No, they
in fact
don't.
enjoy being in the countryside.
No, they don't like being in the countryside either. But they'll be more than happy to drive out, do a 10-minute walk, take some pictures, and then go back home and eat deep fried slop.
Yes, yes. But
But
there's this here from UNESCO, though. The Global Initiative for Information Integrity and Climate Change is a joint partnership between the Brazilian government, the UN Secretariat, and UNESCO, bringing together countries, international organizations, and stakeholders worldwide. It aims to promote and defend information integrity on climate change, address disinformation, and enhance climate change awareness and action. It includes a global fund which will finance research into disinformation on climate change and initiatives to promote information integrity. Very, very managerial language there, but the message is clear. This is the
I
UN
understand.
Department of Climate Change Propaganda, and also countering any other narratives of counter narrative. Again, this has only come out very recently, but this really is. I don't know how anyone can deny that the conversation around the climate stuff is a scientific conversation and not a political conversation. I know we've thrown a lot of science and engineering at people today, and a lot of people are just curious about the nuts and bolts of why this doesn't work. But why this doesn't work in terms of the marketplace of ideas isn't actually that important, unfortunately.
No, it's not. It's about the politics and who is getting, not necessarily even the money, it's who's able to have the ability to shift the money around to whom.
You also highlighted a Substack post here called Poem for All Post-Arcade Civilizations,
Yes, it is.
Contemplations on the Tree of Woe, which I've read pieces from this Substack before. But do you want to give kind of a brief roundup of what this is kind of saying? Because I think it is quite an interesting piece, but you brought this one to my attention. So.
So the piece itself is essentially a refutation from another piece that was done by the actual author of this Substack. So this post itself is actually a guest post from somebody else for the purposes of, I'm assuming on the author's part, objectivity, to provide two different arguments. The one that the author made, that owns the Substack, made this point of where to do with the election of Trump and something to do with the called the Aenean civilization, and that we're all going to go to space. And it was being quite optimistic and hopeful, which is out of not sinker, out of I'm forgetting the word now. Out of kilter, maybe not. Out of yes. kilter with the usual dour, doom-laden view of the West, as it usually is. So the guest that he had on to write this piece provided various statistics, data points from, to be fair, cooked data sets. let's be honest, most of the data provided and that can be easily accessible is not necessarily true, but it's the best we have. And essentially what it is doing is it's pointing out on not just to do with energy production, but also mineral extraction, demographics, population, birth rates, not in a total sense, but actually in a, I'm forgetting the phrase or the terms that are used in it. But it's on a sort of aggregate. You can see it there.
Yes. This little bit here, though, the five stages of demographic transition and some of the refutation, I thought was very interesting. And this does have to do with what we're talking about here, because this has to do with a lot of the future tech predictions that are inherent in a lot of the green technology. It shows here, this is from Our World in Data, and there's a theorized idea that population decrease and what we're seeing, the birth rate collapse, will stabilize, and that we will have a low birth rate, but low death rate, new stable population. Whereas, you know, and the automation can help us basically reach this point where there's a lower population, but everything's stable. Basically, fully, it's them automated doing the whole full automated luxury communism. It just ends there.
It's not communism, it's capitalism, no. Guys. It's
yes.
You make money.
Well, the thing is, you make money in a sense. The techno-globalists and, you know, the people who advocate for the based robotic future, these paragraphs are actually just devastating. This is great, actually.
Yeah, they're really, really.
I'll just quickly read these because it's still true. Society with higher dependency ratios, i.e. stages 4, 5, and 5 plus demographic transition, come across a plethora of issues, which soon prove intractable. Taxes, welfare, and whatnot are hiked up to compensate for society's rapid aging. As the median age rapidly spikes from low fertility coupled with high life expectancy, the shrinking aging workforce is overburdened, and governments resort to mass migration. Automation, robots, and AI ultimately lack the economic and energy margins of the overall fungibility. Sorry, all the overall fungibility. That's really just versatile nature to replace most muscular, highly labor-intensive works. While some automation occurs, this is not enough in the grand scheme. And as someone who's worked in engineering for a very long time, automation, in quotes, is very often a burden. And a lot of the time, you will have a complicated process replace a simple process. Simple. And it may be an efficient, in quotes, complicated process, but only when it's done correctly. You have a simple but inefficient process replaced by a complicated process, which then doesn't work. And that is 90% of the automation I have seen brought into the construction sector. It doesn't work. Yes. It simply doesn't work.
It's the same thing that's been brought into the machining side of, you know, manufacturing metal or plastic components, obviously using a lathe or a milling machine. Again, to use the example with my boss, to do with Nikon, they've got this system set up where they can use the computers to, not program, to set the tooling on a tool holder for a multi-axis milling machine. And then they have this data on a chip that they send with the tool to Boeing, that's based in the UK. And that tool comes with that chip, and you then put the tool in and then put the chip into the computer, and it registers the information automatically, and then it allows you to then continue machining turbine blades or whatever they're doing at Boeing. Clearly not something sufficient enough to keep doors on airplanes, but
no.
that was a cheeky jab, but you know, it did happen. So that's all well and good. I recall asking the gentleman that was running Nikon, I asked him, well, what happens if it doesn't work? And he insisted to me twice that, but it does. And I simply asked him on that third occasion, yes, but I understand that it does. I'm saying, what happens if it doesn't? Is there a redundancy that can be done? And he did assure me that, yes, there is a redundancy. But to me, there seems to be a lot of playing about, and there seems to be a lot of assumptions on everything going right, and all it has to happen is have one thing go wrong, and
well,
then, that could be a 10 grand job out in the bin.
Even if you can get these complex systems to work in the near term, what we're seeing with the, you know, skills collapse and the competence crisis and all this is that long term complex systems don't seem to be surviving. You run out of competent people, or at least the West is running out of competent people.
Yeah.
And what we're seeing here is that, you know, it says automation AI, they do lack the economic and energy margins, overall fungibility, but really they're also just a higher complexity state. They need more internal energy to continue to be maintained. And the internal energy of a system to keep itself maintained is very important. And that's one of the huge things, internal system energy and maintenance energy, that green energy, when you take a country as an electronic system, they do not fundamentally do not understand that part either. And then next bit here is great. Robots and AI are ultimately endogenous variables in the system, subject to trade-offs, economic, ecological, energy, etc., and other related concerns. He's being generous there and saying the best we can say is it's probably a draw. But from what I've seen, it is actually they are entropic within a system generally. In many fields of human, yes, they do. In many fields of human activity, such as agriculture, the limits on automation were reached decades ago, which is true. With nations like the United States registering a stagnant to declining trend of horsepower per unit of agriculture land for several decades. That used to be a great way of measuring the mechanization of farming. But again, it is true that mechanization in the US of farming has reached a saturation point. Farming cannot usefully get more mechanized in the Western world.
Which means that in principle, you can't actually increase the output of your farms via mechanization.
No.
It's just that simple.
It is really just that simple. Yes.
It do be shrimples.
It do be extremely shrimple. Yes. Thank you, Devin, for the £3. No, I do not have an update on the diminutive rotund weeaboo stuff. I wish a certain someone hadn't announced that for me. but it's the bottom of my priorities list, really. I don't do much drama stuff, but there will be something about that at some point. I've got far too many funny anecdotes for that to go to waste. But I will. You're asking about the drama, and we don't really do drama here. We try not to. We try not to do drama anyway.
It would be bad for the brain.
Yes, drama is bad for the brain. Something else we don't think doesn't get talked about as much is, I think people have taken for granted the fact now that you will get cancelled in quotes if you don't agree with climate change. It is one of the, we've talked about climate change denial as a, you know, as a version of denialism. This tread of denialism as a way of labeling somebody has become a very, very big feature of the modern world. And it is one of the several layers of Mott and Bailey when it comes to green energy. Once you prove it is less efficient and more expensive, even with the subsidies, then the fallback position is that the sky is falling. If you do not accept the imminent annihilation of the planet, you are outside of the liberal frame and a form of denier to be discredited. You cannot hold anything other than an ultra-fringe position in academia or politics in the West without conceding heavily to the myth of imminent climate emergency. Ultimately, the scientific arguments about green energy, despite being undeniable, are useless in the marketplace of ideas, as I said earlier, because climate is a friend-enemy distinction in politics. It is not a scientific debate. The same was true when it came to medical arguments and the facts of the lockdown. The facts have no power in the abstract. And as we explained during our sadly removed from YouTube crayon drawing stream, most people do not understand extremely basic physics. So attempting to argue with them about the veracity of green energy green alternatives energy. It is useless. You are dealing with somebody usually who does not have the technical knowledge and the intellectual acumen to properly have that conversation with you. I mean, statistically,
they lack the technical ability to understand how to smack rocks together, let alone how the energy grid functions with green energy.
And when we're talking about the settled, normal ethnic population of Britain, I dread to think of the crayon drawing detail that they have to show. Like, how do you explain like climate Lysenkoism to a newly arrived like Sierra Leone?
I mean, they have a grasp of how fire works, right?
I guess, but then they'd ask us why we're not using the fire anymore. I don't know, maybe we need to turn to some bush wisdom, because bush wisdom would say fire reliable, wind not reliable, me light fire, me not bring wind. Maybe witch doctor does, but I don't know, the witch doctor doesn't seem to be very in control of the wind.
My hotel's running down, help.
Yeah, maybe, I don't know. Maybe if we did like slaughter a goat or something, we could control the wind. But we haven't. We haven't even tried that.
We haven't tried it yet. We haven't tried it yet. Don't start like, you know, jinxing it.
Well, I think that neatly brings me to the end of the. Well, brings us to the end of the notes. There is there any other points you wanted to raise or anything you wanted to shill?
Nothing I can really think of. I think there's maybe one other thing we could show, which is...
Oh no, you disappeared. No!
I'm back.
There you are, Hey!
Sorry about that. It was probably it's the other image of the energy consumption. I think that's a good way to just show where the majority of the energy actually comes from.
Oh, I think, is that this one here?
Yes, it's that one there, which is quite nice. It's very colourful. It's got crayons in it.
It's got nice and colourful, yeah. But that is the chart of consumption. Shows you that,
So, a lot of the energy that is used is not even actually used for, you know, energy. It's not used for construction or manufacturing or even allowing you to play your video games on your computer for, you know, things like that. It's a lot of it gets wasted in just trying to transfer the energy from one place to another.
Yeah, it shows the renewables here. The renewables here have a 65% loss.
Yes. It's crazy, isn't it? Dire.
It's insane.
I think what's also interesting is that you have different types of solar cells. So the majority of the solar cells that, as far as I'm aware, are used, tend to have lead in them.
Yes.
And that's to do with the fact that lead is... I was going to say something then, but I won't do so because I don't know exactly how it works. But they're trying to find a means of not using lead, because obviously the UV causes damage to the lead in the solar cells, and then it causes it to leach out, so which then causes problems because lead. So they're trying to use something else that isn't lead, but then they don't produce anything that has a large enough energy output for what it is. So the lead ones are actually the best ones to use.
Well, it turns out lead's quite useful, and we can't really get... I remember there was a whole initiative at one point to ban lead. Like, there was that whole weird Greenpeace ban chlorine thing, which was really bizarre because it's such an intermediary chemical for basically all of the pharmaceutical and chemical and agricultural industry. But anyway, what a weird thing to say, Greenpeace. But I would say we are still fully monetized somehow. So if you're watching the VOD of this, you can leave super thanks. We do still have memberships available. As I said, the best way not to pay the YouTube tax is the Ko-fi. Do subscribe. Do comment. You know, do appreciate Al Gore's rhythms. We do appreciate the Al Gore rhythms here. So do extol the virtues, if you can't think of anything else, of Al Gore's rhythms in the comments below. But we like your Al Gore dances. But yeah, we're basically fully viewer supported, because it seems our videos have started getting deleted again, which is worrying. Because it's funny, the timestamp they gave me was us literally just reading a definition of anti-Semitism. I'll make a little video about it probably tomorrow and tell people, you know, where they can find stuff in future if this kind of thing happens. But yeah, the Monday stream, it was one of the driest parts of the stream. Or at least one of the least controversial of us just reading something. So that was just funny.
It was just so dull, so boring, and yet causes so many problems.
Yes, yeah.
Stop noticing.
Well, of course, no. We're mostly just concerned, because how could YouTube do this to an account with such an undying and deep love for the nation of Israel?
Remember, we all love the nation of Israel.
What I will say is that thank you for coming, Lewis. Thank you for donating as well. It's been very, very useful. To have some support, to be honest. It's very useful when people donate. It really does, you know, help. We put a lot of time into these, and we're not going to sit here and plead poverty. But it just makes us feel better. Okay, guys, it does. It just makes us feel better.
It tastes nice. All right.
Yes. But the we've come to the end of our stream, so all that's left to do is say goodbye from me.
And a goodbye from me.
Have a good one, guys. Bye.